Hello and welcome to The Scoop, a provincial newscast and podcast with stories from LJI journalists around British Columbia. Each week, reporters from Revelstoke, Cortes Island, Kootenay, Terrace, Prince George, and Smithers will share the news affecting their place in BC. I'm your host and producer, Pamela Hassan, from CSCK News in Smithers. The Scoop was made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada and the Local Journalism Initiative Program, or LJI. Follow The Scoop on CICK, Smithers Community Radio, 93.9 FM, every Thursday and Saturday at noon, online at smithersradio.com, and of course, wherever you get your podcasts.
Today on The Scoop, Red Dress Day memorialized missing and murdered Indigenous women, girls, and two-spirited people at Simon Fraser University. Jesse Wensloff at CJSF in Burnaby has more. Dekel elder Yvonne Perry-Roy is set to receive an honorary Doctor of Law degree for her lifetime of language revitalization work. Ian Gregg at CIFR Radio in Prince George dives in. The North Island College Fine Arts Department's annual student art exhibition explores gender dysphoria through Barbie's form. Heather Watson at CHLY in Nanaimo is on location. And at CICK News in Smithers, Pam Hassan digs into why black knot fungus is the scourge of Houston, BC's Director of Operations for Parks and Public Works, Shirley Hamblin. I'm Dan Messick, and you're listening to The Scoop.
The red dress, hanging from a window, a porch, or a doorway, is a powerful symbol and a reminder of the ongoing epidemic of missing and murdered Indigenous women, girls, and Two-Spirit people. Monday, May 5th, was Red Dress Day, and the National Day of Awareness and Remembrance for the missing and murdered Indigenous women, girls, and 2SLGBTQI+ people. And red dresses hang throughout all three campuses of Simon Fraser University. At the entrance of the Burnaby campus's Student Union Building, a memorial display has been set up by SFU's Sexual Violence Support and Prevention Office, or SVSPO, and the Women's Center, giving students, staff, and community members the opportunity to remember, memorialize, and pay tribute. Constantine Lazitsky, a staff member at Out on Campus, SFU's 2SLGBTQI+ student organization, attended the memorial.
I think it's a very powerful symbol of the red dress because it is so striking and so visual, and then it reminds you just seeing one or two, and then you start seeing more and more of them around campus, seeing them on different campuses, seeing them in the community, just to give you a tangible way to realize the scope of what is happening and how it isn't just, oh, somebody else's cousin or sibling is lost, or somebody else in the community that I'm not really connected to. All of those stories are real, but they may not connect to you in on the same way as it is hundreds and thousands of people that should be here, that should be in community, that should be still doing everything they wish to do, but instead they're not here with us. And so I think it is a way to bring some sort of symbol of them back, to bring something that was taken away, that is no longer here, to bring the people who are important back into the communities where they matter. And so I think it is so important to see visible and proud declarations that this is a day to remember all of the folks that were taken and they're gone, and that we're hoping will one day be returned to their communities.
Paula Quilos-Cruz is an educator with the SVSPO and helped organize the memorial.
Today we are hosting awareness tables and memorials in the three different SFU campuses in Vancouver, Burnaby, and Surrey. We wanted to make sure that non-Indigenous people have a space where they can come and honor missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls and Two-Spirit folks, learn more about it, what actions they can take, to reflect also on their own commitment in how we can change this epidemic as well, and then to have a space to meet with other people and maybe do some coloring pages and some pins. Also bring offerings to the memorial table, or they can take one of the flowers that we have there and they can bring it back to the land or a park close to their home. Thinking about all those sisters and friends and grandmas and aunties and the daughter of someone and some other folks who are no longer here because of this colonial epidemic that is happening in Canada. The Red Dress started as a campaign many years ago that was entitled the Red Dress Project. And it was launched in 2014 by Métis artist Jamie Black. And what this artist wanted to do was to honoring all these women who are no longer here with one red dress. And so that is the symbolism of the red dress, the ones that are not here, but that again are present, and it should be in all our memories to remember that is not something that we need to forget. Create action towards this. It could be something small, something big, but at the end of the day, if we are actioning something, then we're making a difference.
For CGSF, 90.1 FM Burnaby, on the unceded territory of the Hunkaminam and Squamish-speaking peoples, I'm Jesse Wenslaw.
This is Ian Gregg reporting for CIFA Radio's Due North on 88.7 FM. Yvonne Piroy on the personal significance of receiving an honorary Doctor of Laws degree from the university she worked so hard to establish and legitimize.
I'm very honored to receive the degree. When I started working for UNBC in 1992, I started my employment here, and I told myself this is a great opportunity for me to get my degree here as a part-time student while I was working, because there was no university here before, and I couldn't uproot my family and move to Vancouver or somewhere else. So I started working on it. I took a few courses, and then I was asked by the university to co-instruct the Dakel Carrier Language and Culture course. And so I put my own studies aside and started teaching the courses. My late aunt Catherine Caldwell and I developed four levels of language and Dakit language and culture course, and we taught it for many years. And since then, I've also been in the communities and at the university and in the schools and the college, sharing my knowledge of the Dakit language and culture. So it brings me, I'm still doing it today, and now I'm getting my degree.
Your journey of initially coming to UMBC to get an education and then transitioning to delivering an education for other people has been quite a journey over the past several years. As you move into the future, do you have hopes for what else can be achieved on this campus for future students? What do you see the future of language instruction here at UMBC being?
I know with the language and culture, we in the community, the fluent speakers, are working towards the revitalization of the language and culture. It's become an endangered language now. So when I was working here, I was instrumental in having the teacher's diploma program offered in the community. And we did get it offered in Nakasli, and students did their diploma degree. Then a few of them continued on and moved to Prince George campus to get their Bachelor of Education degree. I'd like to see more of that happening. It also was, after it was offered in Nakasli, other communities used that as a template, and a couple other communities have had people go through the program and do their Bachelor of Education degree. I'd like to see more of that happening. My language and culture is important to me and my family, all my siblings, my sisters, and my mom are language and culture teachers too now. My one sister was one of the ones that went through the diploma program, got her B.Ed., and is now acting principal at her community elementary school in Nakasli. And those are my success stories, and I'd like to see more of that happening. I want to remember that along with me is my mom and dad, who taught me my language and culture at a very young age, It taught me who I am and want to remember my late dad and my mom and my siblings, my adult children, my husband, and my mentors with the language and culture after I started sharing my knowledge, who are my late Aunt Catherine Caldwell and Nellie Prince, of course. I've done a lot of work with her. I co-taught the course with her here, and her and I have done a lot of publications and curriculum development together. So I don't want to forget those mentors in my life, too.
You'll be acknowledging the 2025 graduating class at this year's convocation at UMBC. And along with that, you're receiving an honorary degree in law. Does that carry a particular weight for you? What do you think the future holds for you now with that under your belt?
And my first class I took here was Dacat Language and Culture. And it was that first group of students in that first class before the campus opened. We were taking courses downtown in the Quick Start program. And it was our group that suggested the motto for UNBC, Enchahana, which means respect all forms of life, be respectful. And that's one of my main teachings, is to be respectful of others and your surroundings, the plants, the lakes, the trees, the forests, the rivers, the water, the birds, to be respectful of everything with life, and then you'll earn respect. You don't just get it, you have to earn it. And that's what I want, is to try to live that life the best I could and to pass that knowledge on so that everyone's respectful of everything with life.
If I can explore that a little further, is that, do you feel that's your interpretation of what law is fundamentally, or how you'd like to see it applied?
Yeah.
I appreciate it. Thanks for speaking with us today, Yvonne.
This is Ian Gregg reporting for CIFA Radio's Due North on 88.7 FM.
This is a CHLY and CVOX news update. The annual student art exhibition at North Island College in Comox Valley has wrapped up, and CHLY and CVOX met at the studio with one student to hear their experience of exhibiting their own work, a series titled They. Nim Patterson is a multimedia artist who has explored mediums such as drawing and photography in the past, and through a recent sculpture assignment, fell in love with manipulating porcelain casts of one iconic form.
With this process, which I've absolutely fallen in love with, I pour liquid into plaster molds that I've submerged the Barbie parts into, and then the slipcast liquid porcelain hardens, and when I open up the mold, I'm given the perfect imprint of whatever I cast in plaster. And so then I'm able to take out all of the limbs individually and fuse them together and reassemble Barbie in whatever way that I kind of desire. And not a lot of people sculpt with porcelain, so being able to kind of explore it in my own way and find new ways of using the material has been very satisfying.
The work is a vast exploration of gender identity, capturing over 100 moments of Patterson's own experience. It all began with an assignment to make multiples cast from a mold, but Patterson wasn't interested in perfectly replicated forms. They were inspired by a past student's work who manipulated and deflated the form of a rubber duck, but it took them weeks to settle on what form they wanted to recreate and disrupt.
And then it kind of finally came to me where I was like, if there were one thing that I would want to make a cast of and then recreate and remake, it would be my own body. And the idea of recreating myself and recasting my own form really led to using Barbie as my subject, because she's not only, a female figure that I would be able to cast and replicate, but it also symbolically really represents how we're taught as children, what we're supposed to be like when we grow up. And I just felt like that was a really powerful way to express my own gender dysphoria and just the non-binary and trans experience.
The work itself is the display of more than 100 porcelain figures that have been cast from the form of a Barbie, then warped, cut, and altered to represent what Patterson felt in their body in the moment they were creating. Patterson himself added a performative element to the piece, steadily continuing to craft at their station while in drag throughout the span of the exhibition.
So the performance element really kind of came from, like, the last time I had the critique during the semester, and my professor had been like, you making it is the piece, and just like made that as a comment, and I was like, no, this is real, like that's exactly how it is.
Patterson explained that without the performance, people may see the forms as simply Barbie dolls, and that the artist being present, creating and reassembling forms while dressed in drag, honors the concept of the project, and draws the viewers to notice the significance of both gender and the queer experience that is expressed by the work. Something the artist found remarkable about being present throughout the exhibition was witnessing their audience experiencing and relating to their work.
It was really powerful. I found that everyone saw a very specific Barbie that they honed in on and they resonated with like the most, which was really surprising, the versatility in that. I thought that maybe there would be one or two that were like specific favorites, but no, everyone came in and they would just point to like one I would not have expected at all. And they were like, that is me, like that is it, like I am this. So like, I never would have expected just like how diverse the relation that people were having to the project and that different connection that they would create.
Patterson also felt that the piece acted as an entry point for members of the general public who may not understand queerness. That when viewers realized the project embodied experiences of gender dysphoria and trauma, they took the time to observe the piece and ponder what it meant.
And I felt like that was really special because we don't often get that experience where people can just quietly process like that in front of you. So that was powerful.
Patterson said that their initial goals for the project were to create 50 Barbies, but they very quickly surpassed that and are now at 153 and counting. The project is ongoing and their new goal is 1,000, a feat they plan to achieve by buying a kiln and setting up a home studio if they need to. Their next semester will be focused on meeting academic requirements for the fine arts diploma, and Patterson jokes that they will be making Barbies between essays to stay sane. After that, they will likely continue towards a master's degree. As far as where the project will go next, that path is unclear.
Never been much of a planner. I'm just doing it because I love it. And if they end up being somewhere that's not just in my bedroom, piled up on every shelf that I can possibly get in there, then that would be really lovely. Having them in some sort of like gallery or exhibition would be incredible. Purely because the more people who resonate with this project and who can see like a sliver of themselves in it just like brings me so much joy, and I just feel like we need more of that in the world right now.
More information about the North Island College Fine Arts Diploma is available online at nic.bc.ca. Nim Patterson's work can be found on Instagram at nimpattersonart. For CHLY and CVOX News, this is Heather Watson.
This is CICK News. Today on CICK News, I visited Houston for a bit of a tour of Black Knot. No, it's not a heavy metal band, but an Apiosporina morbosa, which is a plant pathogen that's the casual agent of Black Knot, a funky-looking fungus that attaches to members of the Prunus genus of trees, such as Mayday, Plum, and Chokecherry trees that we would see in the Skeena region.
So this here is a black knot infected tree here, and they're all basically Mayday trees that were planted many years ago. The Mayday tree is a beautiful ornamental tree that has gorgeous white fragrant flowers in the spring, but they have a little chokecherry type fruit on them that the birds like. But unfortunately this black knot, as you can see, those are called cankers, all those big black blistery tarry looking thing. That's, this tree is gradually dying. It will eventually die. Wherever the spores land, that's where the black knot begins. So it's not something that's in the tree root, or it's not systemic. It's more localized, but it eventually does kill the tree because as you get more black knot on the tree, there's more spores and it'll infect the whole tree.
That voice that you hear is Shirley Hamblin, the operations supervisor for Parks and Public Works in Houston. We're walking in the tall grass behind All West Glass in Houston near an apartment building where she was showing me what the fungus of black knot looks like on a Mayday tree. Shirley has been working to eradicate black knot fungus on the trees of Houston since 2018. She describes it as a key interest to get ahead of this spore-based fungus, and it's her goal to inform the public early enough in the year to hopefully stop the spread.
So we're working with a lot of private landowners to try and get rid of these trees, and that's why we put in a program this year to offer free pickup if they cut them down.
Okay.
That's what we started on this year, and there was a just over here, there's a whole line of them. It's about 4 dump truck loads from this site over here, which is, it was a whole hedge of tall black knot trees. And you need to cut it down, prune the branches off where the black knot is on those branches, prune it back. Or if they're totally infected like that tree, it was pretty well almost dead. You can see by the number of leaves, it's not leafing out very well.
Yeah.
Then you're better off just to cut it right down.
Okay. Why are they more susceptible? Why are Mayday trees more, or prunus
yeah,
trees?
All the prunus trees. It's just this black knot is the type of fungus that likes those types of trees. So it's good because it won't go on your apple trees. It won't go, but there are a bunch of fungus, they're called cankers, that the fungus will develop a canker. So each different tree species has different kinds of cankers that will grow on it. Unfortunately, this one has proliferated for the last 15 years or so. I don't know what it's due to, whether we just, I think it started downtown or on some of these older properties planted, and then somehow one of these trees got infected, and then it's been gradually spreading out from town into the other properties.
Yeah.
And it's,
How young of a tree will black knot, will it find its way to any prunus trees that it likes? Like, how young? Because I'm almost wondering if, like, are you speaking to nurseries then as well to tell them to look out for it?
Okay,
or
yeah, I've asked one of our local suppliers of nursery trees to not bring them in anymore, because it's really, why invest in a tree to plant on people's property that is going to be susceptible to black knot? Because we're still, I'd say, at least 5 years away from getting this under control in Houston.
Yeah.
And the spores like to release during warm, wet weather. So May now, once it starts to warm up, it's cold today, but once it gets 60 degrees or better, then there's a warm rain, that's when the spores start to disperse. And they can disperse even if you limb off the branches. So it's, and the thing is, a lot of people up here, we can't grow the sweet cherries, but we grow a lot of the sour cherries, and people like those cherry patches too that people like to harvest. And there's some plums, even ornamental plums, that we can grow here. But if we don't get this under control, then none of those things that we would like to grow here could be growing, because it'll just be 4 or 5 years. It's a matter of time. Yeah.
Now, when people are disposing them, or when the town's disposing of them, are you burning them after, or is it just bagged and then once the limb dies and dries out completely, the spores don't spread?
There's about 3 different ways you can handle it. So the best is burning them. And so that's what we did with all the stuff we collected up. It actually got burnt this past week. And then you can bag them. If they're small, if you prune off the infected pieces, bag them, take them to the landfill, or you can also take them out to the landfill. The bigger branches, they have a burn pile there.
Yeah.
The Knockhole landfill, that's just east of here.
Okay.
Yeah. People can take them there. So that's the best way.
And now, because this is an audio format, can you explain to listeners what black knot looks like and how they can identify it from also a young, maybe like when it's starting to when it's, when it's obviously...
You've got the big black tarry knot. Big. So when it is, the first thing you'll notice very easily is that big black sort of tarry, bubbly, fungusy looking thing on your branches. So that's a mature black knot. And that's the one that will start releasing the spores once it's mature. It takes a year, at least a year, after the tree is infected in that spot, wherever that spore landed, then it takes a year for that to become infected. And what happens initially, is that you'll find a swelling where you shouldn't have a swelling. So it'll be around a branch. You'll see it's that area where those spores infected, it becomes swollen. It's unnaturally swollen. It's green, it's still green, but that's part of the stem becomes very swollen. So that's a young black knot. So that's what you want to prune out as well. If you can notice it, especially on a young tree, and get the jump on it, then by the next year, give it that season and next season, it'll be turning black, and then it'll start to put out the spores. So It's hard to tell if you have black knot once the trees leaf out. The best time is in the early spring like this before they leaf out.
Yeah.
And that's when you can start noticing those big sort of ugly sores on your branches.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. And then, and I'm not sure if you're, I don't know if you're going to give me an audio demonstration or whatever, but taking it up, it's merely like, how far down the limb do you have to take it up? Is it spare the limb, save the tree sort of thing?
So when we do our pruning program here, it all depends on a tree by tree basis, like where the black knot is. So if it's up on a branch and out near the end or say in the middle of a branch, you want to remove, you want to be cutting at least 12 inches around, 8 to 12 inches from that infected area.
Okay.
And then you can spray with whatever you're using, your pruning shears or your pruning saw. You just give it a light spray with a 10% bleach solution, and that'll sanitize it between cuts.
Yeah.
Too. So that really helps. But if the black knot is really prevalent, you basically keep cutting. You just cut the branches off, and we've had to remove a couple of trees this year because all the main stems were totally infected. So it's like, okay, now it's time. This tree has to get cut right down. So then I've had it before. Then depends on whether you want that kind of tree again or you want to take a chance on letting it grow, because it will shrub out again. And I've had some of the parks where I couldn't remove them that I've left them, and they haven't become reinfected with black knot yet.
Good.
Which is really nice, because then you can get a sort of regrow your tree, and it'll come in shrubby, like lots of stems. So you can prune those extra stems out and make it go back to tree form, or you can just have a shrubby bush.
Yeah.
So there's other trees that I've pruned faithfully every year. And this year I took out one young tree right downtown, because it just, no matter what I did, pruning and keeping on top of it, every stem each year was getting worse. But that's probably because it's closer to the epicenter of some of the other properties downtown that haven't had black knot removed. So the biggest thing is, don't plant matey trees in this area. Save your money, buy something else. And then the other thing is, realize that this is not a systemic infection. So if you have a young tree or a tree that you can prune every year, just prune out the infected pieces and you can still save your tree. At least, there's still hope down the road if we can get rid of all this extra black knot infected trees from Houston, that you don't have to totally eradicate that type of tree from Houston.
Oh, that's good to know.
So we had some beautiful Mayday trees, huge ones. They were over 30 feet tall on 12th Street down by our search and rescue and on the boulevard there. And they were so infected that we could not prune them and keep heads. We ended up removing them totally. And now, thanks to the BC Hydro Regreening Grant, we are going to replant that area this year with some coniferous species and some other ornamentals. And it'll make a lot of people happy, because folks were quite sad when we removed those big, beautiful trees. But like I said, once they leaf out, you don't see it. You don't see all the black knot and the level of or rate of infection that's happening in those trees. So it's easy to forget just how bad those trees are until they're totally dead.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, thanks. Thank you to Shirley Hamlin, the Operations Supervisor for Parks and Public Works in Houston, for educating me on black knot. And that's this week's episode of The Scoop, a podcast and broadcast featuring stories from remote BC by the journalists in the communities of Smithers, Cortez Island, Revelstoke, Kootenai, Prince George, and Terrace. This program was made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada and the Local Journalism Initiative Program. Tune in next week for another episode, and follow us online wherever you get your podcasts.